So this is the first chapter, second Pali. And we're going to be starting on verse number 7, Shravanayampi. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunatu, Sahariyam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Shravanayapi Bahubhiryo Nalabhyaha. Shravanayapi Bahubhiryo Nalabhyaha. Shrinvantopi Bahavo Yanna Vidyuhu. Shrinvantopi Bahavo Yanna Vidyuhu. Ascharya Vakta Kushalosya Labdhaha. Ascharya Vakta Kushalosya Labdhaha. Yeah, it should be just labdha. Ascharya Vakta Kushalosya Labdha. Ascharya Vakta Kushalosya Labdha. Ascharya Jnata Kushalanushishtaha. Ascharya Jnata Kushalanushishtaha. Shravanaya api bahubhihi yaha na labhyaha. Shrinvantaha api bahavaha yam navidyuhu. Ascharyaha vakta kushalaha asya labdha. Ascharyaha Nyata Kushala Anishishtaha. Okay, Griga. Shravanaya Api Bahubihi Yaha Nalabhyaha. It says at the beginning where Shankara introduces this verse, Shankara says, you know, the one who is a seeker of Shreyas, toward Vidha, such as yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Such as you are, among thousands, kaschit, one person among thousands, means countless. When they say sahasra, means among countless people, so one among thousands, who's a seeker of Shreyas, atmavid bhavati, that person becomes an atmavid, that person gains knowledge of the self, becomes one who knows the self. Tvadvidha, like you, Nachiketas. One who is like you, who is a seeker of Shreyas, so one among thousands, such a person who becomes a knower of the self. He says, then yasmat, then he says, because, and that introduces this verse. So because, he says, shravanaya api, even for hearing, even for doing shravana itself, just to the hearing of this knowledge, bahubihi, by many, yaha nalabhyaha, that, because this knowledge, yaha, that which is nalabhyaha, that which is not available, that knowledge which is not even available, labhyaha, it's not even available, it doesn't come, it's not even gained by many people, even to listen to it, even to hear that there is such a thing, right? And then, if you are so fortunate as to hear it, then he says, shrinvantaha api bahavaha. But many, bahavaha in the plural from bahu, but many, even though hearing it, shrinvantaha, even though listening to it, even though having the shravana, listening to it, yamna vidyuhu, those do not know that, they don't know. They don't understand it, right? So most people never even hear it in the first place. And then many, even though they're exposed to this knowledge, they don't understand it. The yam means that knowledge which, right? Mm-hmm. So now in the accusative, na vidyuhu is in the plural. So those many people, even though hearing, they don't know which that knowledge, which knowledge they do not understand. So then he says, talking about this knowledge, so then, ascharyaha vakta. What are ascharyaha? This verse is very much like in the Viveka Chudamani, the first two or three verses, where they use this ascharya. Ascharya means what a wonder, what a miracle, what an extraordinary thing. So it says, ascharyaha vakta. What a wonder is the vakta, is the teacher. Ascharyaha vakta, from vaktra, nominative singular. So ascharyaha vakta. What a wonder is the teacher. Kushlaha asya labdha. So what a wonder is the teacher. And then also, what a wonder is the one who gains it.
Mm-hmm.
The one who is the gainer, asya, of that. And now, the one who gains that, it's kushla. Kushla means the one who has that skill, that antakarna shuddhi, where both the mind, the buddhi, is capable of viveka. You know, your buddhi, your mind is capable of viveka. It recognizes the impermanence of everything. It recognizes, in recognizing the impermanence of everything, it makes the next step, realizing that these things are not really going to, do not have the capacity to give me what I seek.
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
And then the rise of the mumukshutvam, that desire for liberation. And then with all those things, then having a mind that has a certain degree of antakarna shuddhi, which means a certain degree of viveka, a certain degree of shanti, a relative peace, a certain degree of freedom from raga dveshas, a certain disposition, a disposition that allows for what we call titiksha. Titiksha means that I can maintain my shanti in the ups and downs of life, in the opposites. Because the world is always, you know, just as always does it. It's always throwing the opposites at you. You know, and you think everything is perfect and everything is going so well and you feel so fortunate. Then this mosquito comes. It's shocking how it does that. But those mosquitoes, you know, sometimes they're great big giant mosquitoes. Those mosquitoes are really important. Because it brings you right back to your knowledge. You know, like we were doing in the meditation today. It's just, oh, okay. You have to come, always have to come home. Because the world is not Swargaloka. This is not Swargaloka. This bhumi, this life is 50-50. And it's really, I think it's really just the perfect loka for gaining knowledge, for gaining antakarna shuddhi. Because it's 50-50. As soon as something's going well, it's time for the dip. Time for the rise, time for the dip. And you need to be somebody who has the strength, who develops the strength, the knowledge, the discipline also, to be able to contain that and to contain it in your knowledge. But he's calling it kushala. That means it's the one who gains that skill. So in this contemplation, what we were doing is just kind of going over the skills that we develop in contemplation, in nididhyasana, including inner child work and how to be with people on the outside, just different ways to handle my mind. That's kushala. Having those skills so that you have mastery over them, so that it becomes natural. It becomes natural and second nature for you to bring your mind back to your knowledge. So now he says, so the labdha, the one who gains this, right, who gains this knowledge, the knowledge of this, who is kushala, who has the skill, ascharyaha, what a wonder. And then, so the one who has the skill to gain it is kushala. And then the ascharyaha jnata, what a wonder is the one who knows. Then kushala anishishtaha, the one, what a wonder is the one who knows, having been taught by some, by a teacher. Anushishta means having been taught by somebody who is Kushala. The Ashtar means the Vakta, the teacher, who also is Kushala. Mm-hmm. The student has to be Kushala, has to have those skills and ability to gain this knowledge, and the teacher also has to have the ability to give the knowledge. Mm-hmm. So even in the this knowledge is something that is handed down from teacher to student, teacher to student, teacher to student. It's not a knowledge that can just be gained from reading a book. Because when you're reading a book, for instance, your mind is already defining those words. And so your whole vocabulary exists within the duality. It exists within the realm of your experience. It doesn't matter whether you use a word like existence or consciousness or bliss or ananda or non-dual. Even non-dual has many different meanings. I think I've mentioned before that in my non-dual spiritual counseling class, I often start out with have everybody defining what they mean by non-dual. It's a buzzword. They mean many, many different things. Mostly it's kind of like, yeah, we're agreed on this. Or that the world, everything in the universe is interconnected. There's only one infinite universe and everything is interconnected. It's only one. It's non-dual. There's not two. Right? But they're talking about the interconnectedness of all things as non-dual. That's not what we're meaning at all by non-dual. You know, so all of our to use words and to use this teaching methodology, we can only use words that are seeped in duality. Right? But we use these words seeped in duality in such a way as to point to your own nature, which is by nature non-dual. And since you are already self-evident, already here, these words can be handled in such a way for the mind, for your mind to recognize and differentiate your own presence, your own being, and to actually be able to recognize your own being and recognize the mityatva of everything that you experience, the coming and going nature, the dependency on existence. All of these things you can recognize because it is there to be recognized. If it weren't there to be recognized, if we weren't talking about yourself, then the words would be useless. This is what Jung had this problem, because he'd never been exposed to the tradition, and he said the tradition of teaching or any methodologies that's meant to make you recognize what you are. And so his problem was, if there is such a non-dual pure consciousness, what good is it for me? I can't know anything about that. You know, I can only know what's in the realm of my experience, which is kind of a valid perception. How am I going to know something which does not exist within duality, which I have no means of knowledge to know? Right? And he took consciousness as something to belong to the mind.
And so Who said this?
Jung. And so the mind continues to accrue consciousness. It's Jung, but it's many other people also. And so it's not an ordinary thing to be able to actually handle the Upanishads, or to handle this teaching as a pramana. That has to be taught. It has to be passed on from teacher to student, teacher to student. Swamiji even said, because often people wanted him to kind of write out the formula of, you know, how to do it. Like take each prakriya, you know, and then write out the formula and the steps that you would take. And he said no. It doesn't work that way. You have to yourself experience all of these, each prakriya, and see it and own it and have it work for you, you know, before you can actually give that to somebody else. Because when you're working a prakriya, this teaching methodology, that has to be working internally in you in the same way that it needs to be working for your student. So that both the teacher and the student are taking step by step by step, using those words step by step by step, to to actually point to the reality of your own being, what is meant to be seen. So the, so it's very, he said it's more of an art than, say, a formula. Mm-hmm. And it can be an art because there's many creative ways to do it, and it depends on who's in the class and what the construction, you know, the and all of these things. So it's something, just traditionally, I'm talking, it's something that is passed down, teacher to student, teacher to student, and everybody kind of has the same experience that when you first come to this teaching, and the prakriya, this teaching methodology is in operation, and it's fun, and it's working. It's in operation, it's working for you. It's working for the, it has to be working for the teacher or it's not happening. So it's working for the teacher and it's working for the student. Then what happens is that the mind of the teacher, the ego or the ahankara of the teacher, and both the teacher and student, is just not there. The people aren't there anymore. What is there is this knowledge that is taking place, this seeing. The seeing is taking place, and in that seeing, the words are dropping off because the words are just used to direct the mind to a recognition of something. So the words themselves drop off and you're just left with the vision. That's how it takes place. So then when you walk out the door after the class, you know, you've seen it but you have no idea how to get somebody else there because you've seen it but you've been so involved in the scene that the words that got you there remain so secondary. Mm-hmm. And it's only after a good amount of time that once that vision is kind of somewhat rooted in you, that then the methodology starts to become, you start hearing that and becoming interested in that, you know. But initially that's not the case. Initially you're seeing, not reading the script, and you're not reading the book. You're seeing what the vision has to say. And they even have examples. Like the most famous or well-known example of this is the story of the two little girls who are walking along, and one says, "Oh, look at the crescent moon! Isn't that beautiful? Look at that moon!" The other little girl, I don't know why they use girls for this, but they do. 10th man story, this is a little girl story, okay? So anyway, she's pointing at the crescent moon, and her little friend looks at her fingertip, you know? That's how we can be with the words, you know? Just you're looking at the fingertip. Mm-hmm. And then she says, no, not my finger. Now look at that, you see that tree, you see that branch up there, follow the tree up, that branch that goes up to the left, and so you see that little, where it splits up at the top, they're right through there. So the little girl guides her friend from the finger to the branch to the little V, and then she has to jump to see the crescent moon, you know? So in this case, you know, what if she was stuck on the finger and it's not going to do the job? And so it's a similar here, is that the words are pointing to something to be recognized, whether we're talking about this creation, the mityatva, the changing nature of this creation, the relationship between the changeless and the changing. It's not, oh, well, Vedanta says there's a relationship between the changeless and the changing. It does say that, but when it's functioning as a pramana, you're taking the student to see it. To recognize that's when the pramana is functioning. So that's why they say kushala. So kushala, it has many meanings, but there's layers in here. So this that which is taught, the one who knows, who has been taught by the kushala, by the teacher who has this kushala, by one who has this kushala, this capacity to handle the pramana. And then look at on the part of the student, shraddha, that shraddha is necessary. We shraddha, Swamiji translates that as faith pending understanding, because it's not, in terms of heaven and hell worlds, we say shraddha is a belief in the Vedas, mm-hmm. and the veracity of what the Vedas have to say. But shraddha, in reference to the Upanishads, is a mind that is open to to understanding, to seeing. It's not anything about questioning or not questioning. It has nothing to do with, oh, you don't have Shraddha, you're asking too many questions, you don't have Shraddha. No, questions are part of, that's manana. Shravana manana include deep inquiry. But, so it's not about deep inquiry and freedom to ask your questions. You know, it's about a mind that wants to see. You know, that's different. If the mind wants to see, it wants to understand, then it's available and the questions are in service of understanding. And if the questions, or if your questions are such that the whole shastra falls apart because the question is unanswerable and you've just broken the back of the shastra, of the Upanishads, you've broken its back, you've finished it off. Swamiji said, you know, he uses this kind of example, he says, if anybody can do it, let it be done. If it can be destroyed, let it be destroyed. You know, because if it can be destroyed, it's not the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, the truth is not something that's destructible. You know, if your words and the knowledge that you have is a match to what actually is, how are you going to destroy that? You know? And so don't be afraid. You know, never be afraid of your inquiry or your questions. But that's different than sitting there with a mind who's just dissing the whole thing before and not available to listen. Then such a person is not a qualified student in the situation, you know, because they're not available for it. So that Shraddha is part of the Kushala, but also things like Samadhanam, you know, this Ashama Dhamma Upadati Tatiksha Shraddha Samadhanam. Samadhanam is your mind is available to listen. Some minds are very agitated and have tremendous thought flow going on all the time. And so they're not able to pay attention. And since the knowledge is taking place through words, and your mind is always off and here and there, then that mind needs some sadhanas, you know, to bring what they call this ekagrata, this becoming single-pointed, and being able to hold that for a while. And so such things as upasana and japa and things like that are used to try to strengthen the mind, you know. But then also, I think knowledge also naturally, as knowledge seeps in, you know, the teacher kind of makes an adhikari out of the student also in terms of viveka and vairagya, because viveka, understanding thoroughly viveka, understanding thoroughly vairagya, that's all part of the teaching. And as that starts settling in, and dharma also is part of the teaching, that takes care of a lot of the agitation in the mind. Mm. You know? And when you understand the raga, dvesha, your likes and dislikes and all of that, and what a pain they are, a problem they are, really, you know, then the mind starts to relax a little bit more and becomes more available. But all of these things are what we call kushala. It means that mind is available to gain this knowledge. So the jnata, the one who knows, is the one who has the qualifications to gain this knowledge. That's why this up here it says the kushalaha asyaladha, the one who has that capacity, who has attained this knowledge, being kushala. Mm-hmm. Right? And then that one being taught by the acharya, who also has the capacity to wield that pramana, that one becomes a jnata. Jnata namatav singular from jnatra, becomes one who knows, who has self-knowledge. So he says, what a wonder. So now here, as you'll see as we get into the next couple of verses also, this is Yama really praising now Nachiketas and also praising this knowledge. He's saying this knowledge is not an ordinary thing. This knowledge, you know, most people never even hear of it. They don't have it because they don't have the mumutritum. They don't have the question. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that normal to even have the who am I question. Or what's really going on. It's not very normal. People don't walk around having a who am I question. They already know who they are. I'm this person that does this and this, and my parents are these people, and I have my brothers and sisters. This is what I do for a living, and these are my children, etc. It's answered. This is my job. This is what I'm like. This is how old I am. It's completely answered every moment. This who am I question is answered in spades, in layers upon layers of answers to the who am I question. So what would make a person, you know, really want to know, well, who am I really? Why am I here? What is really going on? Most people would just say, what? Yeah, get it together. Let's go, we've got things to do here. You know? So it's kind of its own unique little tribe of people who are mumukshus, for whom this knowledge even becomes something of interest. And most people have no interest in it. For most people, it's not even there for the hearing. It's not even available for hearing. Right? And for those who do hear it, many, many people don't understand it at all. Mm-hmm. For it to be understood, it's available, but for it to be understood, the student has to have that kushala we've just been talking about, and so does the teacher. Otherwise, that knowledge can't take place, because the pramana itself, the knowledge has to be passed, it has to be handled in a particular way. And so now, he goes into this next verse, talking about, like say you were going to say, well, it should just be logical, right? I can get it through logic. So let's look at this next verse and see what he says. He's really establishing and talking about the pramana here. So verse 8. Na narena varena prokta eshaha. Na narena varena prokta eshaha. Suvignyeyo bahudha chintyamanaha. Suvignyeyo bahudha chintyamanaha. Ananya prokte gatiratra nasti. Ananya prokte gatiratra nasti. Aniyan yatarakyam anupramanat. Aniyan yatarakyam anupramanat. So he says, na narena avarena proktaha eshaha. Suvignyeha bahudha chintyamanaha ananya prokte gatihi atra na asti aniyan hi atarakyam anupramanat. Okay. So Shankara says, as his bridge to this verse, he says, but kasmat. Because why is it such a wonder? Kasmat just means why. Why is it such a wonder? Why is the acharya, why is the jnani, the one who gains this knowledge, the mumukshu, why are they this ascharya about it? Why this wonder? So kasmat. So he says, na narena avarena proktaha eshaha. This atma, eshaha. This esha comes from like ayam. Ayam means this. You know, if we say this versus that. Mm-hmm. That is far away, this is close. Mm-hmm. So eshaha is the closest. Mm-hmm. I am eshaha. This atma, proktaha, being taught, this atma, taught by a narena avarena. Narena means by a man, by a person, who is an avara, means I want to see what Shankara said. Because avara is kind of negative. It means avara. So how's he trans? It means somebody who's inferior. Mm-hmm. By an inferior person. And so Shankara says, hinena. By a person whose buddhi is weak or whose knowledge is weak, hinena. Means that prakrita buddhina, by a person who's just an ordinary person, a samsari in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, a scholar in academics. Mm-hmm. They're a samsari. Maybe they've studied Vedanta and everything, the textbooks and all of that, but they're just a person in the world, not a mumukshu, not somebody who needs this knowledge. You know, doesn't need it. You have to know. An academic is not that. It's just a matter of interest, you know, and it can be profound and all of that, but there's no one inside that needs to know this, really. So prakriti means just an ordinary person. So prakriti buddhi means a person whose buddhi is just ordinary. It can be very brilliant and all of that, but they're not a mumukshu. Mm-hmm. So they're not really a qualified student. They're just a samsari. So he says, by just an ordinary person in the world who may be brilliant, maybe an academician, can be anything, but that mumukshutvam is not there. So this atma taught by such a person, he says, na suvignyaha, is not going to be easily understood. It cannot be clearly understood. Bahudha chintyamanaha, he says, taught by such a person, this person who is chintyamanaha, it is being thought about and contemplated on in many different ways. Right? And that's true. If you look at all of the ways that the self, and this came from previously in one of the verses, the self is thought to be so many different things. You know, some in the Sankhya, it thinks it's just one of an infinite number of purushas, who is just like a little bubble to itself sitting up in the world, up in the air somehow. I don't know. Sitting there, there's many of them, and then there's this physical universe that's made of prakriti, and liberation is for this little bubble, the purusha, that is yours but is infinite, it's mm-hmm. yours, to become totally separated from the individual, you know. And then the Buddhists don't use the word atma at all for shunyata. They don't use the word atma or Brahman, even though there seems to be similarities, so they don't use that word. Other people take the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, to be the atma. The atma is transmigrating. Some people believe that the atma is just this physical body, and it is born and it dies, and that's that. So there are really countless versions of what the atma is, you know. And so this atma, which can be, is being thought of in many, many different ways, is not going to be clearly understood, na suvignyaha, by a person, you know, who has a prakriti buddhi. Means their buddhi is still enveloped within duality. Their epistemological limits of their experience is confined to duality, to within duality. They have no means to get outside of that. And so when that's the case, no amount of logic or reasoning or any of the means of knowledge that you have at your disposal are going to solve this problem. And it's also true, kind of like the giants say, because they're also contained within realities and within duality, and they realize, you say it over and over again, any object, to say you want to know any object, this particular object here, can be viewed from a limitless number of standpoints. So how can you really know anything about anything? So they will say, as so it seems. About anything they say, so it seems. They have a little phrase for it, so it seems. It's just a way of saying you can't really know anything here. Your knowledge can be useful, it can be functional, it can be workable, but because it can be viewed from an infinite number of perspectives, how can you say much about it, right? And so how is there going to be any clear knowledge when the person who's teaching it has a prakriti buddhi, means they're completely contained within duality. And there are men, and from all of these different darshanas and philosophies, there, this bahudha means many and varied. Bahu means many. Bahudha means in many ways. It's in the clinical. So in many ways, it can be thought about in many ways by any prakriti buddhi. So then he says, Ananya Prokte, when it is taught by someone who is not different from the self which is being taught. Ananya means not different. So it must be taught by someone who is that, means for whom that knowledge has taken place. So the teacher, the one who is teaching this knowledge, is that Atma. Right? If the jnani has to, the jnani doesn't take himself or herself to these body, mind, sense organs. It's the functioning ahankara is mitya. The aham lands on the self, that I am. So this knowledge has to be taught by somebody who knows what they're talking about. And that means by somebody who is that, not by somebody who has an academic understanding of what the Atma is. The teacher has to be the Atma. Right? And then if the teacher is the Atma, then that teacher has themselves been put through this teaching methodology. Because your means of knowledge that you have available to you as a human being, your five sense organs, and inference is based on the sense organs, presumption is based on the sense organs, and upalabdhi seeing that there's no elephant sitting on my table there, that's based on, you know, sense perception. All of the means of knowledge and all forms of inference, they're based on sense perception, even though inference can build on itself and presumption can build on itself. In the end, it has to go back to something which is factually known. Right? If the basic inference is false, then all of the building blocks are also false because the basic initial premise is not true. And nothing's going to make that inference true if the initial premise is not valid. And our initial premises have to be something which can actually be known by us. Right? And what can be known by us with the means of knowledge we have available exists within duality. Mm-hmm. Whereas the knowledge has to do with the non-dual reality of this duality, which is not something that our sense perception and our means of knowledge can perceive. And so for a teacher or a person to know this knowledge, the only way to know it is to recognize that you are it. Right? You're not an object of perception, and the only reason you can know yourself at all is because you're self-evident. And the means of knowledge differentiate your being, you know, from the things, the objectifiable things that have been superimposed on it. So you must be it in order to teach it. Because anything less than that means that you're teaching about some opinion, some object that can be viewed in a billion different ways. Count, as the giants are saying, in countless different ways. So what to say then? So he says, Ananya Prokte, when it is taught by someone who is ananya, not different than that, than the self, this eshaha, this atma, then gatihi atranasti, for then there is no gati. Now, then here, atra, here there is no gati. Na asti, there is no gati. So gati can be taken in a couple of ways. Gati can be used as any place that you go after death can be the gati. It means a place that you go. But here, so that's one meaning. Here, there is no gati. There is no place that you go. There is no place to go because you already are that. Right? So for here, when taught by someone who is not different than what they're teaching, there is no gati. Now, in Sanskrit, there's another way to take this. In the sandhi with Ananya Prokte, you see how it ends in an A. Mm-hmm. There can be a sandhi rule here where the gati becomes agati, because that A or O will drop the following A. So this can either read as Ananya Prokte Gatihi Atra or Ananya Prokte Agatihi Atra. And so here, so Shankar talks about, here the agati means avagati. Avagati means knowledge. Wait, how does that go? Just a minute. How does he negate that? Hang on.
Is this Shankar?
No, yeah, it's two ways of taking it. Oh, I see what he's doing. He says, so the agati, that agatihi, he says the agatihi means unavabodaha. He's using the agati to mean, gati by itself to mean avabodha, which means knowledge. The unagates. Avagata begins at a vowel, so it's unavagata. So unavabodha. So agatihi means unavabodaha. Aparijnanam. Parijnanam, the word parijnanam, means knowledge, which is pari, means complete knowledge. Aparijnanam means complete ignorance. Right? So that aparijnanam, that ignorance, there is no ignorance here. So that's the there can be no agati here. There can be no ignorance here. Right? There's no such thing as not knowing. That's the idea. There can be no not knowing when it is taught by somebody who has this knowledge. So it can be, take it two ways. When it is taught by somebody who is what they're teaching, there is no place to go. It's not like you gain this knowledge and then you travel to Swargaloka or something. You already are what you seek. So there's no motion there. So there's no gati. In fact, when the prarabdha karma is exhausted, for prarabdha karma means the karmas that brought you here, that take you through this life, and that karma is exhausted and your body drops, there is no more travel for the jiva, because the jiva is not there anymore. You're already not traveling. You're already with yourself. Your mind is with yourself and you are yourself, right? And so when this body drops off, there's no agnanam, there's no ignorance there to cause you to, there's no fuel to keep you going. You're already resolved into what you seek, and so there's no movement. So for the jnani at the time of death, if that knowledge, if you have that nishta and the raga dveshas have been resolved and whatnot, there's nobody there that wants to go anywhere, and there's no agnanam to move you along. You just are Ishwara, that's all. You're Brahman, who has this maya upadhi that we call Ishwara. So you just are Ishwara. There's no jivatvam left. There's just you as you are with the maya, total maya upadhi. So ananya prote gatihi atranasti. So that either there is no agnan, there is no ignorance left. When you're taught by somebody who is the self, they can teach it to you. Right? And then he says, and that knowledge is, that self is atarakyam, means atarakyaha. It's something that cannot be reached, gained by logic. Logic means, you know, all types of inference and presumption, all the means of knowledge that we have. That, those means of knowledge are not capable of giving me self-knowledge. He says, aniyan, he means because, aniyan anupramana, because of the atma, the self, being smaller than the smallest. It's being smaller than the smallest. It's not objectifiable. I am not objectifiable. Right? And so I'm not a thing in the world. I'm not even a tiny thing. If you get to the smallest possible thing, I'm smaller than that. In some verses it'll say I'm bigger than the biggest and I'm smaller than the smallest. It means I'm not something that can be objectified, you know, like, dear, look at this. It's not possible. And so how can I be a product? How can I be a product of logic? How can I be a knowledge gained through logic? Because logic has to have, what do you call that? Get the name of it. Your logic has to jump out off of initial premise. And so there, it's tied to what we call a linga, something that it relates to. It has to relate to something, you know, for there to be a logical syllogism. Like, for instance, if I, the obvious one that we use all the time, if I say there's fire on the hill, if that fire has to have an invariable concomitance with smoke. It has to, in order to make the jump, you have to have something that it can jump from. And so, in this, in terms of myself, what is going to be that thing, that we call that linga, I don't remember how to translate it, that linga, what is that linga from which it can jump to make the inference? What is that? All that it can be is something that already is existing within duality. And so that something existing within duality can't jump outside of duality. And there can't be a linga there. And so tarka means logic and reasoning, are not going to get you there. However, any amount of logic and reasoning is useful if you have the initial premise. Yeah, but the initial premise has to be gained by a pramana, by a means of knowledge. So your own self has to be the initial premise, right? And then based upon that initial premise of the existence of your own self, the recognition of your own self, then there's so much you can do in terms of the relationship of your being to all other beings, even though that's all in the Shastra. But nevertheless, if your self is known, non-objectifiable, self-evident me, then my relationship to all of the things that come into being and go out of being, and my relationship to non-objectifiable you know, all of those things can withstand infinite inquiry. But that initial premise of your own, the nature of your own being, is not something that can be arrived at through logic, because there's no linga there to make that, by which to make that jump, or to be able to form that syllogism. So that's why he uses this atarakim here. Oh, okay. Maybe the two verses. That's good. Mm-hmm. Only that's it. Om swasti prajabhya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmanebhya shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam kshobha rahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukha bhak bhavet Asato ma sukhamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amatangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om. No, axiom's not the word. I can't think of it. It's right on the tip of my tongue. It's weird.
Assumption? No. A priori?
No. A priori is a good word that I can use, but not in this context.
For what?
Linga. Okay. Now, where's the linga? It's an off.
So, where does this this first premise come from?
The pramana, Vedanta pramana, that makes you recognize the self. Now, pratignya, that's a good, getting closer, but that's another Sanskrit word, but the pratignya is the initial statement in a syllogism. You say something that's initial statement, then you have to prove that it's true. Like if I say there is fire on the hill, that's the pratignya. Now I have to... What?
This is in logic.
This is logic.
Basis. This is from the definition.
Let me see what that is.
Linga?
The linga?
Maybe that's not how you pronounce it.
Here's how what Swamiji says about lingam, that by which you understand something else, a form that indicates all forms, and that's a different meaning for lingam. The form by which one knows Shiva, subtle, the basis for a conclusion.
The basis for a conclusion. Mm-hmm. What would be the lingam in the fire on the mountain?
Would be smoke, is the lingam.
Like the indication, or
the sign. Indicator, yeah, the
sign.
Yeah,
the sign.
Actually, sign, I think, is a word that's getting close, but that might be the word sign. It's a thing that causes you to be able to point to the other thing. I think sign and mark has been used. Mark is not a good one. Maybe use sign.
Is indicator a word that would work? Indicator?
The real word is invariable concomitance, but there's... invariable concomitance means... What that means there is that there's a relationship between the two things that is invariable. And for something like smoke, and this gets very tricky if you ever get into nyaya, there are many mistakes that can be made between in thinking that something has an invariable relationship, this concomitance. Because, for instance, smoke is invariable in reference to indicating fire, but fire doesn't always indicate smoke. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That type of thing. They have several of them that are... It's called ativyapti. Some are ativyaptis, means that the concomitance is too wide, you know. All different kinds of things. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So, you're talking about kushala, by the way.
Kushala, yeah. Kushala, yeah.
It means monk in Tibetan.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, it's an interesting coincidence. But I thought I heard you say various times in the past that Swamiji has said that if you can get it, for lack of a better expression, but you know what I mean, from a teacher who is well-versed in the Shastra, but who doesn't himself or herself really understand, as long as they are really well-versed and they can explain it, and you could still... that seems to be very different than this, so I'm wondering if I'm missing something.
Well, this is kind of the best case. You're not really missing anything, but I'll just explain it a little bit more clearly what Swamiji means. What you really want in a teacher is somebody who is both a Brahmanishta and a Kshatriya, okay? Yeah. The Kshatriya is the one who has really studied the Shastra and has the teaching tradition. It's a Kshatriya. Mm-hmm. Brahmanishta is the one whose life and who is living that, you know. And so what works the best in terms of passing this knowledge is both somebody who's really well-versed in the Vedas and who is also really a sannyasi. It means your whole life is just an expression of that knowledge and you don't have hundreds of other things going on. He started using the word nishta. First, for many years he used the word nishta as being somebody who's well-rooted, like your mind, and he used the fence post example, which is an example that's used. You know, you pound the fence post. You stick a fence post in the hole and then you pound until you can't shake it anymore. That person is well-rooted in this knowledge. Then he started, much later on, using Nishta as somebody who is committed. And that's a very, I kind of like that, actually. It means their whole life is committed to that knowledge. The word is primary for them is that knowledge, and they may be doing everything else, many other things to live, but the core commitment is that knowledge, that person's a Brahmanishta. But it's assuming, because they're a Kshatriya and they're a Brahmanishta, that they have this knowledge, right? They have to have this knowledge. And so that's the person that is desirable. However, to have it as a teacher, it's the best kind of teacher to have. But if the student is a mumukshu, you know, and kushala means they have the viveka and the vairagya and the, you know, samadhanam and shuddha, then the words of the teacher can still act as a pramana. They can act as a pramana for the student, even though the teacher may not be living that, you know, and may not even have as much clarity, the mind of the student is available to see it. And so it functions as a, it's functioning as a pramana, you know. I remember that happened to me. I think my adhikaritvam was very similar to just all of ours. But we're mumukshus. If you're a mumukshu, you're a mumukshu, you know. And if your mind's available for this knowledge, it's available for this knowledge. So I was, before I met Swamiji, I was listening to another Vedantic teacher who did not know about Vedanta as a pramana. And had the Vedanta, and it was more Vivekananda-like, and so I was giving lectures on the Vedanta. And I was listening, you know, and I was listening with great intensity because I wanted to know so badly. And I knew this was it. So I was listening. My mind was like that. And this teacher was just going to tell story after story after story after story. I was just going out of my gourd with impatience. But then there would be this moment where he would say something and I would see it. You know, but of course I would see it, and that scene was real too. But then later on, you see the same thing again, and it's much more contextualized, and it goes on and on like that. But what I'm saying is that, you know, he wasn't wielding, and he even later on in hindsight, you know, he had a lot of unclarity also. But your mind is just totally ready, and I think that's what Swamiji was talking about. And so even if the person is not that clear, you know, but they're still teaching, you can go a long ways with that.
Well, you fill in then, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you fill
yeah,
in.
Yeah, but there's something has to be happening, that pramana has to unwittingly be being used in such a way that you can see it. Mm-hmm. And you may not get, unless you get to a, it can only take you so far. If the person, but that's why they say Kshatriya. Like a lot of pundits are Kshatriyas. You know, they're going to say what is right, even though they themselves haven't really realized it. Like sometimes they'll say the famous pundits in Vedanta, they'll say, Swamiji tells me this, you know, see in the class. They'll say, you know, I'm a householder. I haven't myself really realized this, but this is what the Upanishads say. And then they have a tremendous amount of knowledge, and they have most of it all by heart, and they just have the whole thing, and they can.
Would
just
you expect that to turn them into a mumukshu?
Not without mumukshu term.
But
no.
But I mean, having that knowledge, oh.
It probably blesses you in one way or another, but your heart is not for that. Your heart is still very much in samsara. And so even though it can ring true and everything, there's no one there that's available to really own it up, because your attachment is very much in other places. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about these Western academics who kind of, you know, they know the Sanskrit, they know what the Upanishads say, But they're not really even Kshatriyas because they see it all through the filter of, you know, Freudian analysis.
Oh, and the West and Marxist, this and that. They have no clue. Leninist, it's very frustrating.
Yeah, right. So they're not even really Kshatriyas.
Oh, no,
even
they're not
they
really Kshatriyas.
Right.
And that's another situation that's very tough for a Westerner to have that level of panditya, more, I mean, being a, really a pundit. You know, they a lot of them have not even gone to India, or they've visited India.
Mm-hmm.
They're just doing an academic study.
But they don't like know the Sanskrit quite well and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, but it's just an academic study.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's really...
So that's not even a short trio. Mm-hmm.
So how does that fit with these verses talking about that?
These verses, this Ascharyavat, you know, it's basically what a wonder for this knowledge to take place, because this knowledge is not an object in the world. It's not knowledge of an object in the world. And so the whole desire for gaining this knowledge, the means, the way that this knowledge has to be conveyed, you know, so the one who wants the knowledge, the one who teaches the knowledge, all of this is a wonder because it's not at all how we function in the world. How our mind functions and gains knowledge in the world has to do with the subject-object relationship within samsara. This type of knowledge is completely different. And so even for somebody, you're wanting something, even your desire for it is completely different. Usually our desire is for something that we've experienced out here, you know. And so there's, I don't know, something has to click inside. Because we have, see, this is the thing, we have experienced our being, that I am, I exist. We do experience that, but we only experience it within the context of this body, mind, sense organs, which is finite, and so is everything else. We experience the being directly, immediately, but only in relationship to our objects of experience. And then we experience ourselves as consciousness. Because yes, I am a conscious being. You know, but the consciousness also, we experience it, but we have no idea contextually what it is, because I'm conscious and this is not conscious. And a dead body's not conscious. So what happens to me when the body dies? What happens to my being, the conscious being that I am when the body dies? That I don't know, because it's totally superimposed on my objects of experience. And also bliss experiences come and go, or experiences of deep well-being where I can know this is, because I remember these, you know, this is how I'm supposed to be, this is who I am, this is how I'm, what I'm supposed to be like, you know, and then it would fade away. And I remembered once when it was really intense and I knew this is it, this is how. And I just watched it fade away, you know. And it was like I wanted to grab it and bring it back, but I couldn't. That was a very poignant moment. But we had many moments like that. You know, so it's not like you don't know yourself, but the only way you know of gaining knowledge is through subject-object relationship. And so even to be available, have your mind available for a knowledge that is going to be gained differently than in a subject-object relationship where seer, seen, hear, or heard like that. That's a wonder in itself. Like what kind of, they say it's Ishwara Anugraha, the grace of Bhagavan, Bhagavan's grace. Because what is the thought, what happens inside of you to make you a seeker for that?
It sounds like the point of these verses is more about appreciation for the specialness, the preciousness, the uniqueness of this being a mumukshu and having a teacher who's...
And the teaching tradition and the Upanishads and the Shruti, yes.
All that coming together, and less about, well, it can only work in a certain way. It's...
Yeah, it's...
It's best.
It's a praise.
If the teacher's a Brahmanishta and a Kshatriya, but that's not really the point.
That's not the point.
Okay.
The point is...
the praise
and appreciation of the knowledge, that the knowledge exists, that there is a teacher, that there is a student, And he's going to go on for a couple of verses, and two verses from there, he says to Nachiketas, what we want, we always want to have a student like you, you know. Something like, we want to have a student such as you. Mm-hmm. If somebody whose mind has that Viveka Vairagya and is really available. So yeah, there's praise. There's always praise. Praise for the teacher, praise for the student, praise for the Sampradaya, praise for the Upanishads, to make this, it kind of brings a sense of specialness to your pursuit. A specialness and honor and value, and to really value the pursuit, and to actually talk about why and how it's so special, just to make it more sacred.
Do you think that praise is necessary? I mean, it sounds...
It's very much part of the tradition, but I think it's helpful. For one thing, I think the praise is deserved. Mm. You know, and if there is, it is special, and it is something that's unique.
Yeah.
Not everybody's a mumuksha. Mumuksha is quite rare, actually. You know, it's not like there's a lot of mumukshas.
Well, usually you don't get complimented about it.
Usually not.
You get ostracized.
That's why it's so helpful sometimes, because you can get isolated.
Yeah.
Anyway. Could you say more about the non-objectifiable you?
Yeah.
Like, I am the carpet and the lamp and, I think you said.
Oh. Well,
or whatever.
By non-objectifiable, what we mean by that is that in terms of your experience, what we're used to is a seer seeing, thinker thought, you know, hearer heard. That's what we mean by objectifiable. Anything I can have a subject-object relationship means that thing is objectified. Because I can, if I say objectifiable, it means I'm making it into an object so that I can have a subject aware of the object relationship, where the subject is different than the object. Right? Like if I see you through my eyes, then my eyes are going to be different than the object that I'm seeing. Or if I hear a sound, my ears as the subject are different than the sound that I'm hearing. Or that my mind, which is aware of my ears, the mind is different than the ears that they're aware of. I can turn my mind elsewhere and be aware of something else. So that subject-object relationship is what we're used to. Okay, but here, the self is not objectifiable. You can't make consciousness into an object where consciousness is aware of consciousness as a subject-object relationship. And there's no other consciousness to illumine the consciousness. So you can't have consciousness illumine consciousness. There's not a consciousness behind illumining consciousness, and yet consciousness is self-evident because it's consciousness. It doesn't need another consciousness to come in to light it up, and it doesn't need the mind to be aware of it for it to be lit up. Then the mind would be the consciousness, right? So your own self-experience is self-evident. What we say, swaprakasham, it's self-luminous, it's self-evident. We'll use an example, just as an example. Like the sun doesn't need another sun to come in to illumine it, right? It's the luminary. And so consciousness doesn't need another consciousness to come in and illumine it, to make it known, to make it experienced. It is its own experience. So the problem we have is not in the self-experience. The self-experience of me is ever-present. That's not coming and going, and I don't need any type of thought or means or the universe for that matter to make me be known, because I am knownness itself as consciousness. So the problem is that my mind takes me to be itself. So the mind thinks it is the conscious being, and that means that consciousness then becomes happy and sad and depressed and angry, you know, and smart and stupid and whatever qualities we put on the mind. And then we say, well, you know, the mind actually exists in the body, and so the mind depends upon the body. It's part of the body. And so that this body is finite, and so therefore I am finite. Right? And so there's this mutual superimposition that's taking place between my being and what we call the upadis, these conditioning adjuncts that can take the I, like I am my body, or I am my mind, or I am a quality of the body, or a quality of my mind, or I am the prana. These are all points of identification that I'm identifying. My mind is identifying my own being with something that's actually objectified. And it goes unchanging. And yet the mind keeps identifying me with these things that are coming and going even though I remain. That's why Shankara in this Adhyasabhasha says, this is wild. How is this possible? And yet we do it. There's no getting around the fact that we do that.
The non-objectifiable sounds non-dual, and the you sounds dual.
Well, the non-objective, what the thing is, all these, the yous, I mean, all of the things that can be objectified, would be dual if they had any being, any independent being. But since they don't, and we can establish that they have no being of their own, then they don't make two. It's like the clay in the pot. The pot is 100% dependent on the clay for its being. And so we say the pot form is mitya. It's there, it's experienced, it's practical, but it has no being separate from the clay. So we say that about the whole... We can use another type of example like rope snake. The snake has no being apart from the rope. The only thing really there is the rope, and yet we mistake it for a snake. That's another example of this relationship. So... using these clay pot, rope, snake, wave, ocean, water, you know, we work with these examples to show that this whole creation, including my body, mind, sense organs, and the whole infinite creation, has no independent being of its own for there to be two. Otherwise there would be non-objectifiable me and the objectifiable creation. That's two at the minimum, right? But if the objectifiable creation has no independent being, then there's not two. There's only one. Because you could never say there's the clay and the pot in terms of what is actually there.
So the teacher can reflect being to the student, but why couldn't the lamp with the same amount of clay potness?
Well, the lamp is only being also, but you're only being, I'm only being, the rug is only being. But the mind it's the mind that has the problem, not being. Being is not, yeah. So the mind of the teacher, which knows, has gained this knowledge, can, using the pramana, can make the mind of the student see exactly the same thing. It's like one candle flame lighting another, because it's the same self, same relationship. And there's a teaching methodology that can take you to see it.
The amazing thing is kind of that since all our senses and everything are geared towards objective knowledge, that this knowledge can come in there that's not of an object, right?
And the knowledge is mitya too. All of it's mitya. It's just the object of the knowledge is not.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It shows how well crafted the pramana is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing.
And where could it have come from also, right?
Right.
So in psychology, they see that all the psychology is considered objects as well, right? The
everything. Oh, yeah, everything in the mind, the moods, the emotions, the complexes, the little ones inside, all of those are mitya. But, you know, they work as obstructions and they produce pain. And so within this vyavahara, within this empirical reality, we need to take care of those things. Why shouldn't we? It's also instinctual. If you have pain, it's very instinctual to try to cure the pain. And why would we keep that? Why would we just accommodate the pain when the pain is asking? It's asking to be cured, you know? And the little ones, all of the complexes, all of our hurts, all of our fears, everything, it's asking for a resolution. And a lot of it's just absolutely habitual, and so we need that kushala, you know, capacity, those skills to know how to handle those things as they come up. Mm-hmm. And so then you just, if they're coming up, then you do that. If they're not coming up, then it's a non-issue, right? But if a problem is coming up, then you have, you know what to do. You know how to handle that in a way that resolves it. Mm. You know, with your knowledge and the associated skills with that knowledge, until they don't come up anymore, because they are just habitual. You know, and you get more rooted in your knowledge that there's less and less things come up, because they just don't, because there's not an issue with that given thing.
So, but that means you have to be taking care of the unconscious as well.
I mean, you do have to. You have to know how to take care of it. Mm. You can't just take care of it. You have to know how to take care of it. You have to know what to do. You have to recognize it. Because usually the unconscious, for a person who's not educated around that, the unconscious is recognized through its projections. And the projections are so real. You know? They're absent. So you have to be trained to recognize them, even if you don't believe it's a projection. Yeah, you have to be able to say, even though I do not believe this is a projection, it could still be a projection.
But when you have self-knowledge, isn't it, to some degree, there's a natural unfolding, or a natural revealing of these things? In other words, the projections and everything may still be there, but over time, don't they kind of, in a certain way, become apparent? Because it's such a contrast between the self-knowledge that you have
and everything else. You know, another way of saying that is that mm-hmm. the rugged wishes themselves drop off. Mm-hmm. And as they drop off, the universe is not causing much problem. Mm-hmm. You know? But there's still some unconscious things.
Right.
And so it's just helpful mm-hmm. to know how to work with that in a way that kind of expedites their mm-hmm. their resolution.
And you know, initially, Swamiji just thought that this Pramana would take care of everything, and then later he changed.
We changed it.
Why did he think that?
The Westerners changed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we had the issues, you know.
So for him,
he didn't realize that the wounding in our childhood could be so serious.
So for him, the Pramana itself was sufficient, didn't it?
He thought so. He couldn't have imagined otherwise until. Came up against some of us. and it's not true also. It's also the modern Indians also had the problems, but in the 70s the contrast was more with the West. But you know, he realized then, because he used to just dismiss psychology completely.
Yeah.
He just, no, you know. And but Swamiji's very quick to change. When he realizes something, then he realizes it. And it doesn't matter what he thought before, he doesn't care. He's realized this, and then he learned so much about psychology. He used to ask all of us who were psychologists or studying psychology. He used to read a lot of things, and he had an incredible mind. Like, you would just tell him a little bit, and he would just take it to the nth degree. He's so good at that. And then he started giving so many as he really started to understand. When he had courses like at Piercy and up near Garberville, you know, he gave, and then of course, courses on at Salersburg. He did so many guided meditations that were psychologically oriented, mm-hmm. you know, including inner child work and being with your mother and your father, and also some of these that I do are just his. Like if you have a problem with somebody, sit them in front, you know, and see the interconnectedness, cause-effect connection. That's all Swamiji. Okay, should we call it a night?
Thank you.
Thank you.